Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Peter Worley, the co-founder of the Philosophy Foundation and author of five books, including The If Machine and the multi-award winning The Philosophy Shop. He's going to talk to us today about philosophy in education. Hello, Peter. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, can we begin with you telling us something about yourself and how you became interested in philosophy?
Right. Well, actually, this goes right back to the beginnings of my education, because I was one of those kids. I was one of those naughty kids, you know, pain in the kids who disengaged with education at quite a young age. I didn't really get on with a lot of the teachers. I wasn't really inspired with what I was learning, apart from a few notable examples. And so I found myself sort of moving away from education, drifting away. So much so that when it came to my GCSEs, I pretty much failed them. Just a small handful of C, D's and E's and things like that. So I really didn't get any opportunities to go into further education or anything like that at that stage. And then when I'd left education for a sabbatical, I kind of found my way back into it through philosophy, through, first of all, engaging with religious questions at a younger age, and then later on through reading literature and coming across things like existentialism, so the classic teenage way into philosophy. And then, of course, I identified with this and found that this led on to becoming interested in other aspects of education.
Yeah.
So in ways, you know, such as literature, such as, and then that would lead on to music or to art and to various other things that humanities-based stuff. And then through philosophy, I would then later get interested in things like science and physics and maths as well.
Okay.
So because of the way in which the relationship that philosophy has to all other subjects, I re-engaged with education through philosophy. And then I went back to university at a later stage after doing all the necessary things I had to do to get there.
Okay. And what is the Philosophy Foundation, and why did you decide to set it up?
Well, in a way, this ties in nicely with what I've just said, because the Philosophy Foundation was set up, first of all, to just simply do philosophy with younger children. I was working in schools, primary schools, as a guitar teacher, because I'd ended up becoming a musician earlier on and then becoming a teacher and was teaching the guitar in schools. And I noticed I often worked with small groups of children when I taught guitar. And I noticed an interesting effect, and that was that when I taught, when I arranged something for them to play in an assembly, they might not all be at the same level, and some of them might not be very good, but I'd be able to put something together where they could all play at their own level and then create something that sounded, you know, where it sounded much greater than some of its parts. And I wondered if this, I call this the ensemble effect. And having an interest in philosophy, but also in education and counselling, all these three things came together. And I wondered if something similar might work with children in philosophy. So in other words, the idea is that you do philosophy with one child, it's very difficult to do. With a few, there are obviously some exceptional cases where children can do it, but in most cases, the children just don't have the variety of responses and all the different ways of thinking of alternative positions that's necessary to sort of continue philosophical thinking. However, if you take a class of children, 30 children altogether thinking on a topic, then you get that variety. You get the necessary variety of responses and ideas to sustain philosophical thinking.
So philosophy is social, very much a social dynamic process in many ways then.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Or at least it starts so. And as we see this in Plato, when he writes his dialogues, in which Socrates has these conversations with people in the marketplace, we see a similar thing. There's a process of discussion, dialogue going on. But later on, Socrates describes how this process must be internalized. So the process of discussion with lots of different people then starts to happen within one's own head.
Yeah.
So philosophy becomes a kind of conversation that starts off externally and moves internally. So you're conversing with yourself. And this is precisely what the children are doing. They start off by doing philosophy together. They model to the whole class how philosophy is done in this conversational style, and then they internalize that. And the idea is that after doing this for some time, they go away with this ability to conduct a sustained philosophical dialogue with themselves.
Yeah, interesting. And
that's essentially where and the idea was also, I going back to my original story, was that philosophy had this power to reach children that might not otherwise be reached by education. And this has proved to be the case. Many teachers and head teachers have noticed how children who disengage with the normal avenues of education really, really can often find a place to engage again through philosophy. You know, boys, for instance, especially in the area where I work in Southeast London, many of the boys really don't enjoy, for instance, reading and writing. And this becomes a barrier for their learning. So having an opportunity to do some thinking that doesn't have those barriers because it's conversationally based is really great for those children. Also, autistic children that sometimes find themselves struggling with the mainstream ways of learning really shine in philosophy, particularly in the way that we do it, because we have an emphasis on logic and logical reasoning. And lots of autistic children really warm to that kind of thinking.
Do you think they also like it because there's a perception that there are no right or wrong answers?
Well, this is to some extent true. They do like the fact that they perceive, as you say, there's a perception that there are no wrong answers. But this is a bit misleading in terms of how philosophy works. But it's certainly what happens is that it's probably not accurate to say there are no right and wrong answers. As one child said to me, you know, there are answers in philosophy. There are right answers. It's just that it's very difficult to know what they are. And I think that's a much better way of characterizing the problem. But what they do is they certainly notice that we're not there to judge their answers. As a facilitator, I don't judge them and tell them which are the right and wrong answers, even though I might have a view about that in my head. But what's very important is that we're there to facilitate the group to interact with each other in such a way that they respectfully make judgments of each other.
Yeah.
So when a child says, in their own words, that doesn't make sense because it's contradictory, they might not say those words, but other words, then a child has to come back either to clarify their point or to reevaluate or to perhaps come up with a different theory. So all that's going on, the correcting, the self-regulating that the group does is what we encourage, without at the same time, choosing whose answers are the best. But we're there to help them kind of come to the best answers through a reasoning process.
And the fact that you don't judge, do you ever get resistance from the school in the fact that you don't make judgments?
Yes, this can sometimes be the case. Sometimes, especially if we're doing something, for instance, on the philosophy of numbers and thinking about what a number is or whether zero is a number or, is a number actually the symbol? All these sorts of questions come up. Very often children will start to, during those sorts of discussions, maybe talk about operations such as minus and plus. I was in a class the other day where the children said, if you minus zero four times, you get minus four. So zero minus zero minus zero minus zero equals minus four. Now, there's a sense in which this is wrong. But one teacher said to me, when children say wrong things like that, do you correct them? And I said, no, I don't. It's very important that during this process, during this particular hour of the week in which they're exploring these ideas, that I don't correct them. However, what you will have noticed is that the other children did. And there was one other child that explained that, if you minus zero four times, what you end up with, this six-year-old child said, is not minus four, but one big zero. which was a more correct answer in the sense that it does, of course, equal zero rather than minus four.
So in many ways, what you are cultivating, in a sense, is autonomy and responsibility.
That's exactly right. Some sort of responsibility, some sort of sense of ownership over their own ideas, but ownership not in the way that, everyone's right, but ownership in the sense that they are owning the conversation as a whole. But yes, absolutely, that sort of ability to take something, think about it, come up with something, and then rethink your answers in the light of new and better reasons.
Just going back to our introduction, how did those books come about, The If Machine and The Philosophy Shop?
Okay, well, The If Machine was the first of my books, and that really came about by making a huge number of assiduous notes in my lessons. So after every lesson that I did, every session, I would sit down and record how it went well, what didn't go so well, what I'll be doing again. And then we started, at a later stage, doing some training. And then we started to see what people were doing. We had to try and communicate what we were doing and come up with some expressions for techniques and strategies. And it's literally descriptively writing down all the things we'd done and how we could get better that I ended up with all these notes. And I just simply strung them together when I came to write a book. So the book ends up being very practical as a result. It's full of practical strategies for anybody working with children in how to question well, what sort of questioning will lead to better philosophical discussions and what sorts won't and things like that.
Okay.
And the philosophy shop, that was an interesting thing because the Philosophy Foundation used to be called the Philosophy Shop originally. And then we became a charity, we changed the name to Foundation. But one of my publishers, Crown House, approached me. They weren't my publisher at the time. And they said, oh, we love the name, The Philosophy Shop. Could you write a book around that? And that was the brief. I had to think, oh, my gosh, how am I going to connect philosophy with shopping? But then an idea came to me that actually the whole of Western philosophy has its roots in shopping, in the sense that Socrates began his project in the marketplace. So while people were going around doing their shopping, in a sense he was offering a different kind of exchange, an exchange of ideas rather than exchange of currency.
Yeah, great. I think I know what the answer is going to be here, Peter, but can children do philosophy?
Well, yeah, that's right. It'd be very surprising if I were to say to you no. I think children can do philosophy, of course, otherwise I wouldn't be doing this, but there's two ways of thinking about this. You know, can children do philosophy in 1 hour when I sit down with them? Well, yes, they can, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just, you know, sort of don't quite get there. So there's a way of thinking of it as an arc. Yeah. You know, if I work with children over a period of, say, 6 years, which I have done on a few occasions, then what you might do in year one with children is not necessarily philosophy as you might normally understand it. Yeah. However, you're kind of preparing them for all the basic moves, you know, so asking questions, answering questions, providing reasons. And even with nursery children, this can be done, this basic preparation. However, not long after they've been doing that, you will start to notice that genuine philosophical observations come out, genuine thoughts that are philosophical, and they can start to happen in some cases as young as reception or year one. And then, of course, that grows and develops, and more of those sorts of ideas will happen. By the time you get to year six, they're quite formidable. But I'd say that, first of all, you've got to know what philosophy is to some extent, and this is a really problematic area. But I've got something to start with here, and I'm going to suggest that philosophy is, I've got three R's, as it happens. Philosophy is reasoned. It's always to do with reasoning in some way. I would say that it's always reflective, and it's always revaluative. So okay. These are the three key areas, I think, for doing philosophy, and children can do all three. So, for instance, you can ask a child, get a child involved in thinking about what a whole is. Okay. Any child of any age will very often become interested in just thinking about this. I do this by talking about a donut. This girl bought a donut or a bag of donuts. Normally she eats them, but on this occasion she's not hungry. So she's starting to think about them until she's hungry again. And this time she's not thinking about the donuts, but she's thinking about the holes in the middle. And one question I might ask them is, well, but then I'll put this to them in the form of this character. Alice thinks to herself, you know, is the hole part of the donut? So I can ask this question pretty much to any age group. and they will get engaged in this. And essentially, the question they're thinking about when it's, you know, underneath it all is, what is a whole?
Yeah.
And that's a reflective question.
Definitely.
Anybody who engages with a what is X question, whether it be whole or promise or God or whatever, what is, the moment you start actually reflecting on that question, you are being reflective, as opposed to just saying, well, I don't care, let's just get on with stuff, which is kind of what adults often do. Children are very reflective from the start. Then, of course, they will start to reason it through. They'll start to say things like, well, a whole is anything that you, it's just the missing bit.
Yeah.
And then other children will say, oh, but what about if you take the missing bit out the side? That wouldn't be a whole, would it?
No.
So they start getting involved, they're reasoning through with each other, coming up with a theory of what a whole is, and then someone else comes up with a counterexample. This is classic Socratic moves.
Yeah.
You know, you have a definition, you come up with a counterexample, and then what happens is they go back to the definition and refine it. So classic example, and this can happen with very, very young children. They can do this stuff. And then finally, they become revaluative. Well, I've already described it. The revaluative bit is where you go back to the definition after your counterexample and reevaluate it and come up with a new theory in light of better reasoning. So this is kind of an outline of what philosophy is in a way and how children can do it. And they can do all those things. The only thing you might add to all that is that philosophy has a special kind of interest. So it's not just reasoned, reflective and revaluative thinking, but it's also reasoned, reflective, revaluative about metaphysics or metaphysical issues, such as, you know, what is a whole? What is God? In other words, what is reality? Metaphysics is to do with reality. The other thing is it might be ethical. It might be to do with value.
Yeah.
What matters in our lives rather than just what there is, which is the metaphysical concern. And then finally, there's epistemology, which is not just to do with reality and what matters to us, but what we know about and how we can know and whether we can know anything at all in some cases.
Yeah.
So these are the three areas of what you might call philosophical content. The three R's, as I described them, are the sort of the processes involved in thinking about those content areas.
Why teach kids philosophy?
Okay, so I would say that teaching philosophy is a good thing to do. It's good for all sorts of reasons, but I need to say a bit more than that to most people. So we've already touched upon the fact that you can learn to think better through philosophy. And I think one of the key things about this is that philosophy is the only subject which is entirely dedicated to thinking and how we think. So it's worth doing for that reason. Another one is that you don't need to know a bunch of stuff. You don't need to have a body of knowledge in order to engage in a conceptual inquiry about what a whole is, for instance.
Yeah.
Whereas an inquiry in maths or biology, you need to know your stuff first. So philosophy is liberating in that sense. But I would argue that another good reason for doing philosophy is that, and this goes to our campaign, the fourth R campaign, which we introduced by saying that reasoning is the fourth R. Now, I've since revised this to make reasoning the first R. So I'm being even bolder than I was the first time. A greater temerity here, and saying that not only is the reasoning important, it's of utmost importance, because if you think about it, the three R's are simply skills: reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Yeah.
They're simply skills that you. So these are underpinned by something. And what is it that underpins those skills? Well, it's thinking. It's concepts. You know, what's even more foundational than reading, writing, and arithmetic is how we think. So, for instance, you know, knowing how to write and read is not going to count for much if one doesn't understand what's going on, if one doesn't know why one is reading, or one doesn't know when it's good to do these things. So it's the understanding and the reasoning, which I would argue is absolutely foundational to all the three R's. And the evidence, the Cambridge Review, suggested that reading, writing, arithmetic hasn't improved in 55 years because they've been teaching to the test and not teaching to deepen understanding. So that just goes to show how foundational reasoning is.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me, Peter, in a big picture way. But the way our, certainly in the UK, the way our education system is geared is all about results. Do you encounter resistance with that sort of outlook to your efforts to make it the first R?
Of course you do. I mean, there's, I suppose there's all sorts of arguments, and one might boil it down to economic arguments that we can't be worrying about all this stuff, understanding, who cares about that, as long as people can get on with the jobs they need to do and they've got the skills to basically be able to do it. But this is a very poor-sighted economic argument, because even the economic argument says things like, well, I mean, in this country in particular, we can't compete on things like, you know, resources. We can't compete on things like manpower. Yeah. There's so many ways in which we can't compete. But where we did always perform well in the past was with innovation. And that's where we're starting to lose, well, you know, we don't have the position we used to have in terms of innovation. So if that's the case, then one might say that there is in fact an economic argument to deepen understanding, to improve thinking, because we need to create innovators so that we can compete where we can't compete in things like manpower and resources.
Okay. Why have you sort of plumbed for philosophy in school over critical thinking, or have you, or do you prize them both?
They're both. I mean, as I've kind of implied, if philosophy is reasoned, then there's a sense in which critical thinking is an essential part of it.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, is that to put it in logical terms, if you're doing philosophy, then you will be doing critical thinking.
Right.
But if you're doing critical thinking, it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing philosophy.
Why is that?
So because you could be doing critical thinking about non-philosophy stuff. You might be doing critical thinking just about whether a math sum makes sense. You might be doing a critical thinking about something your friend said about friction. You know, it doesn't have to be philosophical in content to be looking at someone's argument and assessing whether it's a good one. So critical thinking is not necessarily philosophical, but it does become philosophical when you start thinking about certain kinds of topics. And as I suggested, they would be to do with metaphysics, ethics, or epistemology, broadly speaking.
Okay. Are there any potential drawbacks in teaching philosophy?
Yes, I would say that one of the drawbacks is that some people, I mean, this depends on your point of view, of course, so this is a slightly sneaky answer from me, but one of the drawbacks is that some people might see it as a drawback to educate critical thinkers. I mean, I'll leave it to the audience's imagination to think of who those people might be.
Yes.
But that's one possible drawback, is there is an assumption that critical thinking is a good thing to do. There is an assumption in philosophy that, you know, being reflective and reasoned and revaluative is a good thing to do from a young age. So if you disagree with any of those points, then obviously you would see philosophy as being something of a drawback. You believe that children should simply be taught how to behave, what to think, and to be autonomous, if at all, later on in their life, then you're not going to warm to philosophy. So I think that they're the kinds of drawbacks. The other one, of course, is that there is a sense with philosophy that we, because we are committed to free thinking in philosophy, or at least the way we do it at the Philosophy Foundation, the drawback might be that children freely think themselves to a conclusion that you don't prefer.
Yeah.
That you don't want them to come to.
Yeah.
And I think one has to bite the bullet on this. If we promote free thinking, then this is one of the the consequences that to some extent we might have to accept. Having said that, of course, you know, we still expect our children in our groups to behave respectfully to each other, and we teach them so. That's different from saying that they have to come to a certain logical conclusion or ethical conclusion, which some people might want them to do. And it could be seen as a drawback if you see free thinking as not doing that.
What degree of training do you feel is necessary for teachers to be able to teach effectively in, say, a primary school setting? And how does the foundation go about this?
Well, what we do is that we train at the Philosophy Foundation, we train graduates to go in and do this. So we send in specialists to do this. And there's a number of reasons why we do this. One, because we think that to be able to do to be able to do philosophy with children well and to facilitate it well, one has to have some kind of expert knowledge. And this touches on a big issue, actually, with regard to primary education, the issue of to what extent a teacher needs to have specialist knowledge in order to teach at a primary level. And this is a controversial issue with regard to maths and geography and various other areas. But I do think that to be able to do philosophy well, facilitate it well, one needs to have some kind of training in what philosophy is. However, having said that, there are a huge number of transferable skills, for instance, all the critical thinking stuff that we talked about earlier, that is applicable to any subject at any time. So I think that teachers need to get some sort of grasp of that. The worry is, of course, for me, is that critical thinking is not taught as part of teaching anyway. And I think this is a huge problem in education in general. So if I tried to persuade a bunch of teachers that philosophy is worth doing, one of the arguments I would like to use is that philosophy promotes children thinking in argument form and giving them, both thinking and expressing their thoughts in argument form. And I can give you evidence of how this happens through doing philosophy.
Yeah.
But of course, when I say argument form, not a lot of teachers know what I mean by that. And I mean I don't mean shouting at each other, but that's often what they'll hear. Because when they hear argument form, they don't think of the formal sense of argument form, where you have premises and conclusion that to provide a good argument. So it becomes quite difficult to persuade people when they're not familiar with that kind of language.
And
it seems a real, for me, it seems a real hole in the education system or the teacher training system that they are not taught basic critical thinking skills such as arguments, syllogisms, and then classic fallacies.
Do you think philosophy is a useful integrative practice for anyone to learn at any age?
Absolutely. It all depends on how the philosophy is presented, of course. For year one, the way you present the philosophy and do the philosophy with them will be very different to how you do it year six. But it's really important to see the whole thing as integrated, so that what they do at year one is preparing them for what they do at year six, so that by the time they leave year six and go on to secondary school, they have developed what you might call disposition towards good thinking. And this is very important because most people think of good thinking as a skill. Critical thinking is seen as a skill. This goes back to the point earlier about philosophy and critical thinking. And I would argue that that's all very well and good, except for the fact that skills don't always get used. You may have a skill, but not make use of it. So I would argue that what you're really trying to encourage is good thinking habits rather than skills. And this takes time. This takes time for something to be naturalized, for you to be able to drive without having to think about, all the maneuvers. It needs to be something that's internalized and naturalized. But by the time you get to year six, after children have been doing philosophy for a number of years, one of the aims is that they'll go away with a naturalized disposition towards spotting fallacies or whatever it might be. And the interesting thing is that as opposed to a skill where you know what you're doing, in this case, you might not know that you've just identified an equivocation, but you're doing it. You've noticed that as somebody has slipped between two meanings of a word in their argument, and you're able to spot that. So this is the key thing about integrated learning over their whole learning experience, is that they end up with a much more internalized, naturalized disposition towards good thinking.
Yeah, sounds great. And I suppose in this regard, the foundation tries to reach adults as well as children. How does it do this?
Well, that's right. Our remit is to bring philosophy to the wider community. That was our original idea. We've become very much embroiled in education, simply because that's kind of what took an interest in us.
Yeah.
However, we have also developed things like we've worked with BP. We do philosophy in business. We've done philosophy in institutions like the ENO. We went along to the English National Opera to run some inquiries alongside a performance of Satyagraha. We've also done residential courses Some of our specialists run adult groups either at their homes or in cafes or bookshops where people come along and engage in philosophical practice or discussions.
Okay, Peter, what progress has the foundation made since its inception?
Right, well, I mean, it all began in one school. And we've since, I think we're now in 46 schools.
Wow.
That gives you some idea of the sort of progress we've made. And we've also had 300% growth over the last 2 years. So that's double turnover.
Fantastic. And why do you think you've got that growth?
I think it's mainly because there is a real interest in our view on learning and our approach to learning. I think that a lot of head teachers and teachers are very frustrated with the system as it is, feel very suffocated and, you know, knocked about like a tennis ball with each successive government that wants to change things again. So I think there is there is definitely, even though we meet resistance from teachers because of the pressures, as I said earlier, made upon them by the system, such as time constraints and targets, etc. At the same time, I think for this very reason, there is a real strong feeling and move away, if you like, a sort of undercurrent towards this kind of learning. So that's one reason why I think it's grown. But at the same time, I think it might have grown even more if there wasn't the resistance as well. So it's an interesting thing.
Okay. And my last question, Peter, in the middle way society, we see philosophy as a very important integrative practice, especially with regards to the integration of belief. And we have a weekly critical thinking course, for example. What understanding, if any, do you have of the middle way? And if so, how does philosophy fit into this understanding?
Yeah, well, I'm acquainted with Buddhist philosophy, which is, as I understand it, where the idea of the middle way comes from.
Yeah.
In fact, it was one of the ways in which I was introduced to philosophy right at the beginning as a teenager when I did a course with the late Ray Billington, who died sadly last year. And he used to teach courses in Eastern philosophy. So I became acquainted with this. And interestingly, even though I'm trained as an analytic philosopher, I have this very different background. And as I understand it, the way we work at the TPF does have a kind of middle way about it. You may have picked up on this already in some of the things I've said. So, for instance, we don't judge the children,
yeah.
But we also don't go to the extreme of saying that there's no such thing as a right and wrong answer in philosophy. So this is kind of what I might describe as a middle way.
Yeah.
We also have a principle that we call absence, which that is an example of, where we encourage our specialists to when they're facilitating a philosophy conversation with anyone for that matter, not just children, we encourage them to be sort of present but hidden, sort of paradoxical kind of expression, which is, I think, very much a kind of middle way of expressing things. Present but hidden, so they're there to kind of effect progress within a discussion, philosophical progress, but not to sort of step in with their own interpretations, their own views, their own points, and all this, that, and the other. So this principle that we call absence, which is seems to me to be getting at that kind of middle way. Also, there's a book I've read recently, The War for Children's Minds by Stephen Law, where he makes a really interesting case for liberal education in terms of, he says, look, you know, you need to be careful that if you're a liberal and you're trying to promote liberal values, you've got to be careful that you don't just become another authoritarian.
Exactly.
In other words, you know, my children are going to grow up to be tolerant and respectful and all these wonderful things, but I'm not going to give them any options. I'm going to sort of brainwash them into this view. And he says that this is just as bad as the extreme right religious person who brings up their children.
Exactly.
So the important thing is to, he says in his book, the important thing is to introduce children to the tools and strategies that enable them to then engage critically with everything that's put to them when they grow up. So by the time they are adults, they're able to make informed decisions, not just about newspaper articles and not just about that, but also about the views of their own parents, about the views of their own immediate community,
yeah.
And their peers. And I think that's absolutely right. And that seems to me to be That seems to me to be a kind of middle way,
a
correct way of understanding how to approach the teaching of liberal values.
Just a reflection on what you were saying there about judgment, Peter. In the middle way society, we very much view objectivity in an incremental sense. So rather than saying things aren't absolutely right, but things are absolutely wrong. What's your view on objectivity? Do you see it in a very binary way with subjectivity, or can you see it in an incremental way?
Oh, I think this is an incredibly deep question and hugely problematic. But I think in the end, as a philosopher, when involved in the practice of philosophy. Because I said to you earlier that a key aspect of philosophy is revaluation.
Yeah.
I think it's important for philosophy to not take a view on objectivity, okay, in the ultimate sense. So, obviously within philosophy one may make a case for objectivity or subjectivity or realism or anti-realism or whatever it may be. But in the end, the philosophy as a process has to be revaluative about that. It has to say that whatever theory you come up with on this is open to investigation, open to critical reflection, just like everything else. And the interesting thing about philosophy is that it's also not just reflective, but reflexive. And yeah. By that I mean that it's self-directed.
Yeah.
So not only are we asking that, everyone else to be reflective about their practices and their methods, philosophy has to do so about itself.
Yeah.
So any philosopher who tells you that as a philosopher you must be committed to this theory of truth or this view of objectivity is not being philosophical in the true sense. They may make a case for it. They may say, I think that one should be, but they should always remain open to the possibility that theory of truth or whatever it may be wrong.
Yeah.
So the very demands of philosophy itself mean that we have to remain to some extent open-minded, but that doesn't mean that we are not allowed to put forward cases. But as a broad practice, when I'm working with the children, for instance, I'm simply open to what cases they are that are going to be put forward.
Okay. Well, I think that's what I meant, that we see objectivity as incremental and provisional, that it's not absolute.
Provisional. That's a nice way of putting it. Yes, that's right. And that just seems to me to be the way it is as a human being. You know, one is never, it's the default position of all human beings. One is never in a position to say, right, that's it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, Peter, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting interview. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.